Mitchell recalled. Shepard took his famous golf shot. Mitchell performed a javelin throw. After spending 4 hours and 35 minutes on the lunar surface and setting a new distance traveled record of approximately 9,000 feet, the astronauts arrived at Antares and climbed inside. They stowed their lunar samples and prepared for takeoff. With the push of a computer key, Antares blasted off the moon. After approximately 1 hour and 47 minutes, they succeeded in rendezvousing with Stu Roosa in the Kitty Hawk command module. On the way back to Earth, his disappointment was profound, Mitchell recalled. They had come all this way and failed to get to the target. Peering out the spacecraft window, Mitchell stared down at planet Earth. He thought about his family. He thought about his country. He thought about his life in the military and the current war in Vietnam. And he became overwhelmed with a thought he'd never considered before. Particular scientific facts about stellar evolution took on a new significance, Mitchell explained, stellar evolution being the birth of stars when time began. This was not religious or mystical, but something else, he said. Sitting there in the command module, he experienced what he later described as a flash of understanding, its full meaning somehow obscured. It was silent and authoritative, he recalled in 2015. But with simple clarity, he said, he understood one universal truth. Man is connected to other men through consciousness. That was the link between inner space and outer space. He felt a peacefulness he had never experienced before. Later, he would identify this feeling as Salvikalpa Samadhi, a term from ancient Sanskrit that means perfect oneness with the universe. Mitchell looked over at his fellow astronauts, wondering whether they were experiencing this too. Time passed. Mitchell pulled out his 5 Zener cards and twice repeated his mind-to-mind telepathy tests with the 2 physicians and the psychic Olaf Johnson in Chicago. These were tests that all parties had agreed to keep secret. He couldn't wait to get home. After the astronauts landed, they were quarantined for 10 days. One morning during breakfast, Shepard was reading the newspaper when a headline caught his eye. Astronaut does ESP experiment on moon flight, it read. Al Shepard doubled over with laughter, Mitchell recalled. Shepard showed the article to Mitchell and made a comment about how journalists had no shame, how they were willing to fabricate stories just to sell newspapers. There was an awkward moment of silence, remembered Mitchell. Then he told Shepard, "I did it." Someone from his small group must have leaked the story. Shepard looked nonplussed, Mitchell remembered. He silently returned his attention to his breakfast plate. The subject was never brought up again. Around the world, Mitchell's ESP experiments became a kind of running joke. The headline in Mariv, Israel's leading newspaper, read, "Captain Edgar D. Mitchell, the Uri Geller of the astronauts." It did not take long for the press to get hold of the data from Mitchell's outer space ESP tests. Out of 200 attempts to communicate telepathically, the psychic in Chicago got 51 correct hits, roughly the same as chance would predict. When Mitchell tried to defend the failure as a product of timing, he said his astronaut workload delayed his telepathic transmission time by roughly 1 hour. Skeptics had a field day. But the world's ridicule did not matter to Ed Mitchell. He was a changed man. For 6 months after his return from the moon, he honored his obligations to NASA, shaking hands with prime ministers and presidents, kings, congressmen, and high school students. But his worldview had shifted. He redirected his focus toward an understanding of what consciousness was. "The topic of consciousness," he said, "is as vast as the cosmos and as close to us as sleep." The reason he'd performed ESP tests in space was because telepathy demonstrated that there is an information linkage between people that goes beyond the laws of science as they are presently understood. From now on, he was interested only in pursuing subjects that purport to examine or explain man's purpose on this earth, man's attempt to understand himself and the nature of the universe, he declared, is the ultimate frontier. His thoughts about society took a negative turn. "I began thinking that there was something wrong with ideas such as nation and state. From this viewpoint, it is only logical to make war on other countries and on the countryside," he said. "There had to be another way." The denial of the non-material aspect of life, its sacred participation in the miracle of existence, he wrote, "this leaves people with no source of meaning and direction in life." Ed Mitchell had gone to the moon and come back, and he was profoundly disappointed by what he returned to. The resulting view may be stated thus: "I am simply a prisoner," he said. "The only hope for happiness was to seek a higher understanding of consciousness." This was his new quest. Mitchell began spending all his time with people who shared his ideas about consciousness and mental telepathy. He made new colleagues and friends. He left NASA. He divorced his wife. In November 1971, at a convention in Houston, he met Andrea Puharik. The two men became fast friends. Puharik interested Mitchell in a research idea. He'd recently traveled to Israel, Puharik said, where he'd tested a young man named Uri Geller, who had extraordinary mental powers. "Not only was Geller telepathic," Puharik reported, "he had psychokinetic abilities that allowed him to stop and start watches and to bend metal with his mind." Puharik was preparing to bring Uri Geller to America, he said, to be studied in a laboratory here. Perhaps Ed Mitchell wanted to collaborate on a Geller project with him. Mitchell needed no time to think about the proposition. The answer, he told Puharik, was yes. The Apollo astronaut was on board. Chapter 8: The Physicist and the Psychic. Inside a laboratory at the Northern California think tank, Stanford Research Institute, SRI, a young physicist named Harold Hal Puthoff sat down to write a letter. It was March 1972. Puthoff was an expert in quantum electronics and electron beam devices. At age 35, he was a bit of a prodigy, having already co-authored the university physics textbook, Fundamentals of Quantum Electronics, published 23 papers, given 14 national symposium lectures, and registered 2 patents, one for a tunable infrared laser. The letter Puthoff was writing was addressed to a New York City man named Grover Cleveland Cleve Baxter, a former CIA analyst whose area of expertise was detecting deception. This letter would alter the course of Hal Puthoff's life. Puthoff was on a quest to answer one of physics' great unsolved questions. "I was interested in questions like, what is life? But also in questions like, why is life? Was physical theory as we knew it capable of describing life processes?" Puthoff explained in 2015. Cleve Baxter had recently performed an experiment that Puthoff thought might point him in an interesting new direction on this quest. "I wanted to obtain a small grant for some research in quantum biology, Puthoff recalled. In 1972, Puthoff was a rising star at SRI, the second largest Defense Department research institute in the country after Rand Corporation and located in the heart of Silicon Valley. Founded in 1946, SRI performed a broad spectrum of scientific research with an annual operating budget of $70 million, roughly $400 million in 2017. Of its staff of 2,600, more than 400 had PhDs. Puthoff was slight in build, thoughtful, and soft-spoken. Because he often appeared in the lab with baggy circles under his eyes, some colleagues described him as a Mick Jagger look-alike, but with a larger derriere. Before working as a laser scientist, Hal Puthoff had worked for U.S. Navy intelligence. As a young lieutenant in the Naval Reserve, he was loaned out to the NSA to work on a classified, code-breaking program called Project Lightning, involving ultra-high-speed supercomputers. Top-secret work was interesting, Puthoff found, but he decided that a traditional career in the military was not for him. He began focusing on quantum physics, on esoteric concepts including quantum entanglement, zero-point energy, and how quantum theory might account for biological life processes, hence the question, why is life? The year 1972 was a unique time to be an American physicist with links to the Defense Department. The 1950s hard science approach to defense problems was beginning to thaw. In the aftermath of World War II, science became swept up in a wave of technology, says Puthoff. Everything was about mechanization, about apparatus-based inanimate physics. In general, any kind of philosophizing about physics dropped away, he recalls. Most scientists followed the Feynman dictum, shut up and calculate. In the late 1960s, metaphysics, with its interest in abstract concepts such as knowing, being, identity, cause, time, and space, began to make a comeback. Physicists began thinking about life processes again, Puthoff says. Questions about biology, or what Puthoff calls animate physics, were back on the chalkboard. Physicists like Puthoff began to ask the age-old question, where does human energy come from? Quantum physics has yet to explain basic life forces in biological systems, Puthoff says, starting with, why does a cell divide? I wondered, are there fields and forces involved that we are not seeing in regular physics? He began searching the literature coming out of the world's top research labs. This led him to the world of Yakov Terletsky, chairman of theoretical physics at Moscow University and winner of the Laureate of the State Prize, and Gerald Feinberg, a physics professor at Columbia University. Both men were working on hypotheses involving a subatomic particle called a tachyon. In America, scientists had recently proven the existence of numerous previously unknown subatomic particles, including the neutrino, the muon, and the quark. The tachyon is proposed to be superluminal, faster than light, but not forbidden by quantum physics, says Puthoff. I wondered, could it be, maybe, that in the tachyon flow, that was where there was the extra field? That field, or force, physics can't see. It was in pursuit of the elusive and theoretical tachyon that Puthoff sat down to write his letter to Clive Baxter. Baxter was not a scientist. He was a deception researcher and interrogation expert, a man rooted in the intelligence community where he had worked for more than 25 years. He had earned his stripes in World War II in the Army's Counterintelligence Corps, where he conducted narco interrogations of enemy forces, Early attempts to get POWs to reveal military secrets using so-called truth serums. After the war, Baxter joined the CIA, where he co-founded the agency's polygraph program. The polygraph, or lie detector, works on the assumption that deception can be detected by measurable changes in human body functions, including pulse, respiration, and perspiration. In most people, the fear of being caught in a lie produces anxiety, which in turn causes these individual levels to change. Baxter authored the CIA's infamous lifestyle issues test, a series of questions that asked of each prospective CIA employee things like, "Are you a homosexual?" and "Do you take drugs?" For over a decade, Baxter administered these tests, monitoring applicants' reactions with a polygraph. Eventually, he moved to New York City and founded the Baxter School of Lie Detection. There, he began training FBI agents and state police detectives the art of detecting deception. He quickly became an expert witness for law enforcement, testifying in courtrooms and before congressional committees. Colleagues like to say that Clive Baxter could always spot a liar, but he saw the situation from a different point of view. "I like to think of the polygraph as a truth detector," he said. Then on the night of February 2, 1966, a single experience changed the direction of Baxter's life work. The way he told the story, he'd been up late working in his office on a hard-to-crack FBI case when his eyes landed on a new houseplant his secretary had recently purchased for the office. He wondered what would happen if he administered a polygraph to a plant. Are plants aware? Baxter attached the polygraph's sensor pads to the plant's leaves, set the levels on the machine, sipped his coffee, and thought about what to ask the houseplant. Then he got an even better idea, he recalled. Why not try to elicit a more direct, potentially anxiety-producing effect? He decided to set the plant's leaves on fire and see whether the polygraph recorded a measurable change. "Something remarkable happened," he said. As he prepared to strike the match against the matchbox's ignition strip, the lie detector readings spiked dramatically. It was a eureka moment for him. Plants had consciousness, he was convinced. And even more interesting, he later explained, was his next realization. His experiment suggested that plants had extrasensory perception and could communicate with other life forms. The plant perceived that it was going to be burned by Baxter's lit match and reacted with a measurable change, he said. He wrote up his findings as "evidence of a primary perception in plant life," which was published in the International Journal of Parapsychology in 1968. He called the results of his experiment the Baxter effect. His work would eventually become the subject of the best-selling book, The Secret Life of Plants, by journalist Peter Tompkins, a former OSS officer, and Christopher O. Byrd, a CIA operative. Skeptics and scientists tore the Baxter effect to shreds, starting with the fact that plants lack a nervous system. Baxter's methods were amateurish, naive, and irresponsible, they said. Baxter was not a scientist, and his experiment did not adhere to scientific method. As of 2017, no other scientist has been able to repeat the experiment under strict laboratory controls. But the idea of plant sentience inspired others to consider the possibility. Indeed, Charles Darwin, who studied plants all his life, once observed that the root tip, or radicle, acts like the brain of one of the lower animals. Undeterred by his critics, Baxter stood by his experiment. Such high resistance to new ideas does not concern me, he said. I have a truly wonderful ally, Mother Nature. By the time Hal Putoff wrote his letter to Baxter, the former CIA polygrapher had broadened his experiments on plant sentience. In a follow-on experiment, he cut a houseplant in two, then moved the halves into different rooms, where he burned the leaves to see whether distance affected the polygraph response. His conclusion that a plant's ability to register fear and read minds was not limited by distance was the experiment that caught Hal Putoff's attention. I wanted to do a similar long-distance experiment, remembers Putoff. For over a year, he had been tracking the work of international scientists who were on the tachyon hunt. Physicists were doing all kinds of experiments in search of the tachyon, says Putoff. Cosmic ray experiments, accelerator experiments, but they were all apparatus-based, inanimate physics experiments. The one place no one had looked was in biological organisms, in animate physics, which is how Cleve Baxter fit in. My idea was to grow an algae culture, split it, then separate the cultures by a distance of 5 miles. Then I'd zap one culture with a laser, burn it, see if the sister culture responded. Putoff's experiment would attempt to answer two questions. The first question was, do living organisms really interact at a distance? If the answer was yes, then the second question was, could the existence of tachyons provide the answer as to how the organisms communicate? Putoff wrote Baxter and included a copy of his proposed algae culture experiment. He wanted to know what Baxter thought of his idea. The letter arrived at Baxter's lab in March 1972. By then, Baxter had moved on to a new series of extrasensory perception experiments involving humans and plants. His human research subject was an artist and a psychic named Douglas Ingo Swan. Ingo Swan, by his own account, had been considered odd since the age of 3. As a boy growing up in Telluride, Colorado, he was not just doubly or triply strange, he said of himself. I was quadruply freaky. He experienced premonitions and saw the auras of people around him. When he closed his eyes and went into a dream state, he could leave his body and travel to other places, a situation understood and accepted by his maternal grandmother, who was also sensitive. Swan's family encouraged him to study hard at school, develop his art, and channel his spontaneous shifts in perception and awareness into his work. In 1955, he graduated from Westminster College in Salt Lake City, with a double major in biology and art. He had plans to become a scientist and to get a PhD in genetic research, but instead enlisted in the U.S. Army and served 3 years in Korea. After he left the Army in 1958, Swan moved to New York City, determined to pursue a career in art. To pay the bills, for the next 12 years, he worked as a clerk in the office of the United Nations Secretariat. But at night and on weekends, he worked on his passion and his craft. And it was in the New York City art scene that he met a legendary woman, a painter, muralist, and high society entertainer named Buell Mullen. Mullen moved in a circle of the powerful. She had painted portraits of world leaders, including President Eisenhower and Madame Chiang Kai-shek. She loved to give large sit-down dinner parties in her glamorous studio on Central Park South, its tall windows facing on Central Park, Swan wrote in an unpublished autobiography. One of her favorite topics was psychic phenomena. Swan found this amazing, he said. For the first time in my life, I was able to witness the actual but hidden extent of the demand for psychics among the wealthy among politicians, Wall Street types, cultural gurus, and even among the very powerful. Swan was even more surprised to learn that many of these individuals financed ESP experiments. Cleve Baxter was one beneficiary. This was reminiscent of the way Alice Astor Bouverie, Marcella DuPont, and Joyce Borden Balakovic had financed Andrea Puharik's work 2 decades before. At one of Buell Mullen's parties, Ingo Swan met Cleve Baxter. The two men hit it off. Swan asked Baxter if he could come to his lab. "What I wanted to do was see plants responding to human thoughts," Swan later recalled. He was also at a turning point in his life, having recently left his day job at the UN to focus on his artwork. In order to support himself, he'd taken a job as a guinea pig for psychic research. Most of the work came from the American Society for Psychical Research, ASPR, the oldest such organization in the United States, founded in 1885 by the philosopher and physician William James. Despite its fancy offices inside a beautiful brownstone at 5 West 73rd Street, behind the Dakota apartment building, Swan generally disliked working at the ASPR. In his opinion, most of the PhDs in residence were small-minded and snobbish, fueled by bureaucratic pettiness and self-righteous indignation about who was psychic and who was not. At ASPR, Swan had been working with the director of research, Karlis Osis, the Latvian-born PhD who specialized in deathbed visions. This was the same Dr. Osis who'd participated in the U.S. Army's classified ESP tests with cats, starting in 1952, back when Osis worked as a researcher at J.B. Rhine's Parapsychology Laboratory at Duke University. Now, Osis was using Swan for a series of experiments purported to involve out-of-body experiences, OBEs, also known as traveling clairvoyance. The Osis-designed OBE experiment had Swan seated in a lounge chair inside an office at ASPR and wired up to a refrigerator-sized machine called a Beckman dynograph, which recorded his physiological signals on magnetic tape. Across the room was a tray suspended from the ceiling. Osis's assistant, Janet Mitchell, would enter the room carrying a box with an object hidden inside. She'd ceremoniously climb a ladder and, out of view of Swan, place the box on the tray. When she was ready, she'd indicate to Swan that the experiment had begun. "I was expected to practice floating up out of the body to the ceiling and utilize my out-of-body eyes to spy down on the targets hidden on the suspended trays," wrote Swan. "Take your time," Janet Mitchell would say. "Don't feel nervous because that raises your blood pressure and distorts the brainwave feedouts," Swan recalled being told. Very quickly, Swan said he could see what was hidden in the box. The problem, he said, was that he had great difficulty trying to articulate what he saw. Osis found this unacceptable and got mad. Swan's description of the items was inadequate, he said. Swan asked for a pen, and instead of trying to say what he saw, he drew what he saw. Osis and Mitchell were thrilled with the results. So thrilled, they said, they planned to repeat these experiments under tightly controlled laboratory conditions and submit the results to the Psychology Board of America for review. Ingo Swan was fascinated by the tray test results, but for a different reason. There was a myth or legend in psychical research and parapsychology that psi subjects, i.e. psychic people, need time to gather their wits and for their impressions to start coming in, he wrote, as if target identification required time. Throughout history, there existed the conception of mediums rubbing their temples or gazing into a crystal ball, concentrating and waiting for the phenomenon of extrasensory perception to occur. I was finding this anticipated slowness not true at all regarding the experiments at the ASPR, Swan noted in his journals. I found, or eventually noticed at any rate, that the moment I set my attention onto the target, well, there it was, instantaneously, he wrote. I first noticed this on the earlier, informal, long-distance experiments. When Janet said she was ready to record the brain waves, my attention went to the target without any delays. I then noticed this had also been true in the case of the out-of-body experiments as well, and with all of the other kinds of experiments, too. The OSIS experiments helped Swan identify something he'd not considered before. Psychic functioning occurred at light speed, metaphorically at least. Swan decided to call this concept the speed or velocity of psi signals, or instantaneous connection to the psi signals. He'd mentioned this idea to some of the PhDs at ASPR, and they'd dismissed it. After all, he was not a scientist, and he lacked a PhD, they said. No one knew what I was talking about, said Swan, except Cleve Baxter, who told Swan that he'd recently received a copy of a research proposal from a physicist named Hal Puthoff, who was pursuing a related hypothesis at the Stanford Research Institute. Swan wrote a letter to Hal Puthoff. Swan said that if I were interested in investigating the boundary between the physics of the animate and inanimate, I should consider experiments of the parapsychological type, remembers Puthoff. Swan also referenced some apparently successful psychokinesis experiments he'd done in a laboratory at the City College of New York for Gertrude Schmeidler, the experimental psychologist and Harvard PhD who'd famously coined the parapsychological concepts of sheep and goats. Puthoff wrote back, inviting Swan to come out to California and be tested in a lab at SRI. The experiments would take place inside a Faraday cage, under strict laboratory controls. For the first time in American history, Puthoff said, psychic functioning could be examined from a physicist's point of view, not from the perspective of a psychologist or parapsychologist. Swan said he'd think about it. Privately, he noted in his journal that he'd spoken way too soon. Puthoff's offer intimidated him. The following month, on April 26, 1971, the American Society for Psychical Research held a large reception to honor Ingo Swan, Dr. Carlos Osis, PhD, and research on out-of-body experiences. The way the story was presented in the ASPR newsletter, an independent judge from the Psychology Board of America, allegedly blind to the fact that she was judging out-of-body experiments involving ESP, determined that Ingo Swan had correctly made and matched picture drawings of items hidden from view, and that this was a 100% match, which was considered far above chance expectations. When a second judge asked for a retest, Swan allegedly again scored a 100% match. The test results were going to be the lead story in the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research, and the evening's grand reception was honoring this milestone. Reception for Ingo Swan expanded awareness in art, the sign outside the venue read. Mr. Swan has been participating extensively in ASPR experimentation on out-of-body states. The gathering promised to provide guests with an opportunity to see Ingo Swan's artwork and to meet the man with the X-ray eyes. Scores of reporters were invited, and gossip columnists too. Ingo Swann had mixed feelings about all this, he said. He was naturally shy and prone to feeling self-conscious in crowds. In his journals, he lamented that he'd recently put on a lot of weight. By now, I was so fat, I couldn't fit into any nice United Nations suits, of which I had an even dozen, he wrote. During the week before the reception, I had drank only liquid protein in an effort to reduce. While dressing, I felt I was getting ready to volunteer for the guillotine. Then, what the hell, he thought. While slowly and reluctantly squeezing into my clothes, I smoked 10 cigars and drank 5 vodka and sodas. And so I arrived at the dreaded reception a half hour late. It was 1972, and out-of-body experiments were in vogue. A huge crowd of people showed up for the event, and in local newspapers the following morning, Swann was hailed as New York City's super psychic and the Superman of Psy. But there are at least two sides to every story, as Ingo Swann soon found out. I learned that I was, among other things, a drunkard, a debaucher, an alcoholic, a homosexual. I wasn't married, and so, it was said, I must be gay. One gossip columnist noted that Swann was writing sex novels and speculated that maybe he was a pornographer. When it leaked that he and Cleve Baxter were doing psi experiments with biologicals, the rumors took a salacious turn. The gossip line exploded regarding how and from whom Baxter got his specimens and under what circumstances, lamented Swann. The disparaging press devastated Swann, but it also compelled him into action. He would go to Stanford Research Institute and be tested by a real physicist, he decided. Forget New York City with its double standards and its gossips. Either his extrasensory abilities were real or they were not. At SRI, he would be tested scientifically, and the reality of psychic functioning would be vindicated. Or he would fail, and psychics would remain on the fringes of society where they'd always lived. If extrasensory perception was proven to be a figment of the imagination, chance, or a host of other disparaging things people had been saying for centuries, so be it. Swann decided he'd take a risk. What else really did he have to lose? He would accept Hal Puthoff's invitation after all. The only problem was, he lamented in his journal, he was fat and had no clothes. Why not shed that old idea too? Swann decided to undergo a welcome shift in attitude and perception about his own physical body, about himself. After the reception at the ASPR, I began receiving invitations to dinners and parties by the score, often from people I didn't even know. I suppose everyone wanted to see what this odd mixture of gossip looked like. I became mildly amused by watching people try to fit me into their usually limited stereotype concepts, and took a small revenge by doing everything I could not to fit into any of them. Like a snake shedding its skin, a new Swann emerged. And since he could not fit into any of his conservative clothes, I bought new ones at used clothing stores and wore them boldly everywhere I went. But these tended to be religious, police, or military clothes of one type or another. I mixed these with ordinary clothes and went to the dinners and parties wearing them. I was expected to be abnormal, and so it was a pleasure to present myself as such. It was liberating to Swann. He felt free of the bondage of this old idea that it mattered so much what people thought of him. Prior to this, he explained, I had tried very hard to not be considered an oddity. Now that changed. I said to myself, to hell with not trying to be an oddity. Let me just experience being my true self for a while. And so he started appearing in public, dressed in various new ways, adding what he called discreet costume elements to his daily attire. In June 1972, Swan boarded a plane for California, ready and willing to be tested by a physicist at SRI. When he arrived at the San Francisco airport, he was dressed all in white, white cowboy boots, white pants, and some kind of white religious frock. The ironic part was that Hal Puthoff barely noticed, and if he did, he did not bat an eye. The Stanford Research Institute was located 30 minutes south of San Francisco, which in 1972 was the hippie capital of the world. Hal Puthoff's physicist colleagues at SRI warned him not to get involved with psychics. Anyone who claimed to have extrasensory powers was a charlatan or unstable or both, they said. Puthoff took note but remained undeterred. He decided to design a fail-safe psychokinesis experiment, he recalls, one in which there was no room for fraud. I was able to gain access to one of the best shielded devices on the planet, a superconducting shielded magnetometer used for looking at subatomic particles known as quarks, he said. In 1972, the quark was hypothesized to be a subnuclear constituent of nuclear particles such as protons, but not yet isolated outside of a nucleus. And the search was on. The quark detector Puthoff borrowed for the Swan psychokinesis experiment was a highly sensitive machine designed to look at decay in a magnetic field. Puthoff's colleague, Dr. Arthur Hebbard, of the Stanford High Energy Physics Laboratory, had access to a magnetometer for quark experiments, and Puthoff made arrangements with Hebbard to borrow it. In documents declassified by the CIA, the magnetometer had been developed under an Office of Naval Research contract and is of the superconducting quantum interference device Squid variety. It was now located in a well, i.e. a basement, under a building called the Varian Physics Hall. The SRI campus was located at the southernmost tip of San Francisco Bay, on the edge of a tree-filled park called Ravenswood. SRI was home to many government-funded programs at the cutting edge of the U.S. military and intelligence community's science and technology effort. One of the first nodes on the ARPANET, SRI had a cybernetics department and an artificial intelligence division. Its researchers had recently made history when they became the first in the world to wire a man's brain directly into a computer. For more than 50 years, SRI had been part of nearby Stanford University, but in 1970, the school's trustees were forced to sever ties with SRI after student protesters exposed the fact that the institute's majority funding came from the Department of Defense, which rendered it a partner in weapons development during the Vietnam War. As Hal Puthoff and Ingo Swan walked across the Stanford campus, Swan noticed that many windows had been boarded up and others were covered with metal grates. At Varian Physics Hall, Puthoff and Swan made their way into the basement where the magnetometer was located, down a set of stairs, through a long gray corridor, and into a room marked by bright orange earthquake engineering supports. The ceilings were traversed by pipes, vents, and conduits and had an industrial research lab feel, Swan recalled. Puthoff introduced him to Arthur Hebbard, Martin Lee, and six doctoral candidates, all of whom had come to Varian Hall to bear witness to this test. The men shook hands. Swan felt conspicuous under the glare. In one corner, a chart recorder scribbled away, its pen moving methodically across a scroll of paper. Unperturbed, the magnetometer registered what is generally referred to as a straight line, but what is technically called an oscillating wavy line. On the walk over to Varian Hall, Putoff had told Swan what to expect. He was going to be asked to perturb the magnetometer in a psychokinesis experiment similar to those he'd done with Cleve Baxter and Gertrude Schmeidler. Now, scanning the room, Swan realized the magnetometer was nowhere to be seen. He asked Putoff if he could take a look at it before he tried to perturb it with his mind. "You're standing on top of it," Putoff said. "The machine was 5 feet below where they were standing," someone volunteered, "buried in concrete." According to documents declassified by the CIA in 2000, one of the scientists explained how the quark detector worked and indicated that the function that looked for quarks was turned off. He pointed to the chart recorder and said the magnetometer had been running for an hour now with no noise or perturbation, hence the recorder's uninterrupted oscillating wavy line. Swan asked what this machine looked like so he could at least visualize it. Another scientist said that the design of the device had never been made public, which made it impossible for anyone to have pre-existing knowledge of what it actually looked like. The only thing ever written about this magnetometer was that it contained what was called a Josephson junction, two layers of superconducting material sandwiching a thin layer of non-superconducting material. The configuration was named for the British theoretical physicist Brian D. Josephson, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1973 and became a vocal proponent of extrasensory perception. The horrible implications of all this dawned on me without much difficulty, Swan later recalled. I was being asked to poke around with a target I could not see or even know exactly where it was in the ground beneath. Swan surveyed his surroundings. From his perspective, all 9 witnesses were smirking at him. He became angry, Hal Putoff recalls. His wrath focused on me. On the walk over, Putoff and Swan discussed the desirability of a subject being completely informed regarding the experiment he or she was to undertake. Swan now feared he'd been set up to fail and to be ridiculed. "How the fuck am I supposed to influence something I can't see?" Swan yelled a little too loudly for the staid environment. Putoff tried to assuage his fears. "You wanted an experiment with no loopholes in it," he reminded Swan. "Well, here it is. This was a test in which it would be impossible to cheat. If Swan were to affect the magnetic field in the magnetometer, it would register on the chart recorder. Since it was impossible for Swan or anyone else to touch or access the magnetometer, presumably the only way for Swan to affect it would be through what is generally referred to as psychokinesis." "I was angry but not stupid," Swan recalled, taking stock of his options. If he walked out, there would be 9 witnesses to his retreat. He'd already been humiliated by the New York City press. He knew how that felt. And if he walked out, he'd never know whether he would have succeeded or failed at this scientific test. "So, as in Cleve Baxter's lab," Swan wrote, "I started probing, whatever that means." For a few minutes, he concentrated with all his mental might. "Nothing registered on the chart recorder," Putoff recalls. "Zero. Nil." Swan looked up. 2 of the doctoral candidates seemed to be smirking. Swan asked for a piece of paper. He said he wanted to sketch a drawing to help him focus on what he was being asked to perturb. No one had any paper, so Putoff tore a piece of used chart recorder printout from a pile on the floor. Swan began to sketch the magnetometer as he saw it in his mind's eye. After a minute, he pointed to his drawing and asked, "Is this the Josephson junction?" If so, I think I can see it quite well. As he spoke, the pen on the chart recorder gave a small jerk. All eyes went to the machine, Putoff recalls. For a brief second, the recording pen stopped. Then it began lifting up again, this time high above its previously uninterrupted oscillating wavy line. For roughly 10 seconds, the pen registered two wide wavy lines. Jesus Christ, Swan heard someone mumble. Is that an effect? Swan asked, pointing to the wavy lines. Putoff and Dr. Lee began whispering. From Swan's perspective, Dr. Hebbard looked pale. Can you do that again? Putoff asked. Swan said he would try. He concentrated. The pen moved again. Putoff shook his head. I thought, I'll be damned, Putoff later recalled. Putoff walked over to the recorder and pulled off the paper. All the scientists had been standing near Swan. None had touched the chart recording equipment, and yet something in the magnetometer had been perturbed. This left Putoff with only one conclusion, he would later write, and that was that Ingo Swan had perturbed the superconducting shielded magnetometer by some means outside the range of well-understood interactions between human subjects and the environment. Putoff asked Doctors Lee and Hebbard to sign the chart paper as witnesses to what they had observed. The two physicists signed. Swan remembered a commotion in the room and watched as one of the doctoral students suddenly ran out, as if spooked. In such a hurry, he hit his head against an orange structural support on the way out. What had just occurred defied scientific principles as they were then understood. Not one, but two mysterious phenomena had occurred, according to Putoff. The passive perception of information through some, as yet, unidentified communication channel, and the active perturbation of the functioning of a laboratory device. That night, Hal Putoff, his fiancée Adrienne Kennedy, and Ingo Swan went out for ice cream to celebrate. Swan recalls having a chocolate milkshake, then a strawberry milkshake, and finally a sundae with five flavors of ice cream. After eating, they returned to the Varian Physics Hall basement lab. Dr. Hebbard had left the quark detector running to make sure it was not malfunctioning. Several hours had passed since the detector registered the effects of the psychokinesis experiment, and since its cessation, there had been no perturbations in the chart recorder's signal, just a thin, uninterrupted, oscillating wavy line. It was time for Swan to return to New York City. Driving to the airport, Putoff asked if he would consider returning for a second series of tests. No way, Jose, Swan replied. He felt confident that the results of the magnetometer experiment would make their way through the American Society for Psychical Research community, and he could at last feel a modicum of revenge. I could rest on my laurels, wrote Swan. I felt great. As for California, he had no intention of returning. He did not feel part of the SRI scene, he recalled, and the sunshine there was way too bright. Putoff wrote up his findings and sent his report to various colleagues at SRI and on the East Coast. Weeks passed. One afternoon, he was sitting in his office when there was a knock on the door. I wasn't expecting anyone, he recalls. When he opened the door, he was surprised to find two men standing in the threshold, a copy of my magnetometer experiment report in hand. Their credentials showed them to be from the CIA, he recalled. They knew of my previous background as a naval intelligence officer and then civilian employee at the National Security Agency several years earlier, and they felt they could discuss their concerns with me openly. Putoff invited them into his office and closed the door. There was, they told me, increasing concern in the intelligence community about the level of effort in Soviet parapsychology being funded by the Soviet security services. They said that by the standards of most Western scientists, the field of parapsychology was considered nonsense. But the CIA wanted this subject investigated from a hard science perspective. As a result, Putoff explains, the CIA had been on the lookout for a research laboratory outside of academia that could handle a quiet, low-profile, classified investigation, and SRI appeared to fit the bill. The CIA men asked Putoff if he could arrange to carry out a series of additional ESP experiments with Ingo Swann, simple ones, sometime in the next few months. If the test proved satisfactory, they asked Putoff, would he consider a pilot program along these lines? Putoff said he was open to the idea. In August, ignoring his previous vow, Ingo Swann returned to SRI. So did the two CIA intelligence analysts, identified to Swann as scientific colleagues from the East Coast. With Swann in a shielded room, a Faraday cage, the team conducted a series of what's-in-the-box tests, in which small office supplies were hidden inside a box, then set in front of Swann, who was asked to identify what was hidden inside. During a lunch break, one of the CIA analysts decided to disrupt protocol. The objects concealed in boxes that had been secured with a seal had been chosen in advance of the test, meaning that if fraud was being perpetrated, here was an opportunity for Putoff or someone else at SRI to help Swann cheat. One of the CIA officers decided to create a spontaneous, fraud-proof test. He walked outside into the SRI garden and located a small brown moth. He captured the moth alive, placed it inside a box, then closed and sealed the lid. He took the sealed box into the room where Swann had been waiting. "Can you tell us what's inside?" the CIA officer asked. Swann stared at the box. According to transcripts declassified by the CIA, Swann said, "I see something small, brown, and irregular, sort of like a leaf or something that resembles it." Swann paused, then said, "Except that it seems very much alive, like it's even moving." The analyst opened the box. Clinging to the lid was the small brown moth. 2 weeks later, on October 1, 1972, the CIA awarded SRI a contract for $49,909 for an 8-month research project. The program, classified secret, was given an obscure name to conceal its purpose. It was called the Biofield Measurements Program. Putoff's colleague, Russell Targ, a fellow laser physicist with a long-time interest in parapsychology, was brought on board to assist. What Hal Putoff did not yet know was that arrangements were being made to bring Uri Geller to SRI 2 and to have Geller tested on behalf of the CIA. The results, called the Swann-Geller phenomena, would set the stage for more than 20 years of classified government research into extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, and extraordinary human functioning. Chapter 9. Skeptics versus CIA. In anticipation of its program involving psychics at SRI, the Central Intelligence Agency sought to establish ground rules and decorum. The world of purported paranormal phenomena was incendiary territory, a declassified CIA memo makes clear, a strange domain that science could not explain and that most agency personnel were loath to condone. We are not in the business of pursuing paranormal phenomena per se, but we try not to be arrogant about it, which is what a lack of objectivity about any issue usually amounts to. After the euphemistically titled Biofield Measurements Program was approved and funded, representatives from the CIA's Technical Services Division and its Office of Research and Development put together an informal preliminary conference intended to establish the proper context for a proposed investigation into various purported paranormal phenomena. Those invited were told, "We wish to keep the conference low-key and limit the attendance as well as general awareness of the conference and the proposed investigations." The SRI tests were to be a closely held secret, even within an agency of entirely classified operations. Ground rules for the conference were laid down. "We do not feel that it makes any difference whether, at this stage, you are a believer or non-believer or somewhere in between," the memo stated. "In the spirit of scientific detachment, we merely seek your counsel in an approach to a problem which has eluded definitive resolution for eons, and of course may continue to do so." The CIA had no expectations that its psychic research program at SRI would solve the age-old mystery of ESP and PK overnight, but it was not afraid of trying. Decorum would be paramount for success. "There will be no rehashing of anecdotal accounts. There will be no idle, discursive speculation about the dynamics or meaning of the phenomena. That is what we hope eventually to establish. We merely ask that you come with an open mind and prepared to address yourself generally to pertinent questions. By establishing an impartial, value-free approach, the CIA was trying to set a high bar for success. If the phenomena are verified, what practical, offensive or defensive, applications might you envision for your component at CIA?" the conference organizers asked. One of those in attendance was Christopher Kit Green, an analyst in the Life Sciences Division. Before joining the agency, Green had considered becoming an Episcopal priest, but decided against it after 2 weeks in seminary. Instead, he earned a PhD in neurophysiology and later became a medical doctor. At CIA, Kit Green wore many hats. Some of his time was spent creating top-secret evaluations of the health and mental stability of foreign leaders. In another capacity, he worked on biological and chemical threat analysis as part of an agency effort to determine how weaponized toxins affect certain regions of the human brain. "My specialty was forensic medicine," says Green, "a rare area of scientific expertise used in determining what might have made a person ill or caused their death, based on very little and often incomplete data." In other words, if a CIA agent died under suspicious circumstances, Green was called in to conduct forensic analysis of the body. For this work, he was eventually awarded the National Intelligence Medal, the CIA's highest honor. "I was interested in individuals who operate at the outer limits of human behavior," Green explains. He studied human performance in extraordinary circumstances, including the physiology of astronauts and submariners. It was also Green's job to understand the cutting-edge space and submarine-based life support systems of foreign governments. He attended international conferences on religion, mysticism, and the paranormal in order to analyze emerging trends before they became full-fledged movements. Some say I ran the weird desk, he says. Green had been with the CIA since 1969, and in 1972, he was assigned to the psychic research program. One part of his job was to oversee the administration of medical tests on the psychics at SRI. This included everything from blood tests to brain scans to tests for personality disorders. With the invention of the CT, computerized tomography, scan in 1972, brain imaging offered exciting new opportunities in neuroscience. From the perspective of an analyst, this was exciting territory, says Green. We wanted to try and determine if individuals with extraordinary abilities had brain scans that were different from their fellow man. With the imminent arrival of Uri Geller in November 1972, CIA anticipation was high and secrecy was paramount. Kit Green had been personally handling the Geller matter since he was assigned the job by CIA Director Richard Helms. Declassified memos reveal two focused concerns during this time. One was Geller's celebrity, and the other was the presence of Andrea Puharik, who had by now taken on a Svengali-like role as Geller's official manager. Given Puharik's notorious background, the CIA needed to keep him at arm's length from any agency affiliation. The issue was temporarily solved by using Edgar Mitchell's newly formed Mind Science Institute of Los Angeles, later the Institute of Noetic Sciences, as a conduit for payments to Puharik and Geller. But the problem of Geller's celebrity was not such an easy fix. In the months since Puharik first presented his research proposal to CIA, Geller had become an international phenomenon. Wherever he went, the press followed along. He was young, handsome, single, and spoke perfect English with a slight Israeli accent. From Barbara Walters to Brigitte Bardot, fans around the world could not seem to get enough of Uri Geller as he bent spoons, read minds, and performed simple telepathy acts. In the months leading up to Geller's arrival in the United States, he'd been traveling around Germany with journalists from Bild Zeitung. As part of a six-part series on Geller, the newspaper printed fantastical stories about his alleged paranormal powers. Geller reportedly stopping a cable car on Mount Hochflin in Bavaria, bending handcuffs at a Stuttgart police station, halting an escalator in a Munich shopping mall. In a matter of months, Geller amassed a legion of dedicated fans, but also an army of foes. The intense public interest followed him to America. Puharik made matters difficult for the CIA by constantly involving the press. Geller's first meeting in America was with Wernher von Braun, former chief scientist of the Apollo moon program, and Puharik made sure that a reporter was invited along. During the meeting, Geller asked von Braun to take off his gold wedding band and hold it inside his closed palm. I put my hand over his and in my mind said, bend, Geller recalled in an interview in 2016. According to one news story, when von Braun opened his palm and examined his ring, he saw that it had been bent into an oval shape. Uri Geller has bent my ring in the palm of my hand without ever touching it, von Braun told the reporter. Personally, I have no scientific explanation for it. There was a second incident with von Braun that commanded the attention of the Pentagon. After Geller bent the ring, von Braun told Geller that he had an electronic pocket calculator that wasn't working. The batteries had been charged, but there was no power. The calculator simply wouldn't turn on. In Von Braun's estimation, something had gone wrong with the electronic circuitry, and he wondered whether Geller could influence the electrical system. Geller held the machine in his hands and concentrated. Several witnesses in Von Braun's office confirmed the rocket scientist's declaration that the electronic panel inexplicably lit up. When analysts at the Pentagon learned of the incident, they ordered a briefing. Part of this briefing has been declassified and is quoted in a report entitled Paranormal Phenomena, Briefing on a Net Assessment Study. It would not be conceptually difficult, for example, to imagine the utility of psychokinesis, if feasible, in disrupting the electrical systems associated with an ICBM's guidance program, as displayed by Uri Geller, they wrote. There remains a serious need for detailed analytical studies of some of these phenomena by specialists in various scientific disciplines. There was a great challenge facing anyone working on this kind of study, the analysts warned. The subject matter tends to be polarized into uncritical acceptance or total rejection of fact. For as long as the research field was polarized into this kind of childish battle between true believers and the incredulous who dismiss the matter out of hand, little progress was likely to be made. At SRI, Hal Putoff and Russell Targ hoped they would be the scientists to break this stalemate. By the time Geller arrived in Menlo Park with his entourage, which included Andrea Puharik, Edgar Mitchell, and Geller's assistant and friend, Shippy Strang, security had become an issue, remembers Kit Green. Geller was a foreign national, and in November 1972, Arab-Israeli tensions were escalating. Because of concerns that Geller's trip to America could be an Israeli intelligence operation, a security sweep of the SRI engineering laboratory was made in advance of Geller's arrival. The ceiling panels, walls, and furniture were all checked for electronic bugs, remembers Putoff. Finally, with the distractions out of the way, the scientists began testing Geller in the lab. Between December 1, 1972, and January 15, 1973, Putoff and Targ completed 9 days of official tests with Uri Geller. The experiments were recorded on film, videotape, and audio tape simultaneously. According to the scientists, Geller's tests with dice were among the most statistically significant. In these tests, he sat sequestered in a room with Putoff and Targ, while an SRI researcher in a separate room placed a single square die inside a closed metal box. The sealed box was brought into Geller's room, then shaken by a technician, and placed on the table in front of Geller. Mr. Geller would then look at the box without touching it and call out which die face he believed was uppermost, states the declassified CIA progress report. Geller gave the correct answer each of the 8 times the experiment was performed. The probability that this could have occurred by chance alone is approximately 1 in a million, the scientists informed the CIA. A second experiment delivered even more extraordinary results, according to another declassified CIA report. This test was run by a CIA representative working inside an electronically shielded room. The representative lined up in a row 10 identical aluminum film canisters with stainless steel tops, then placed an object in some of the cans, leaving others empty. The objects were a steel ball bearing, a small magnet, and several droppers of water. Geller was brought into the room and scanned with a magnetometer. His hands, mouth, and ears were photographed and checked for electronic and magnetic devices. Once he was seated in front of a clear glass table, with cameras recording his hands from two different angles, each test began. He would either pass his hand over the row of cans or simply look at them. He would then call out the cans he felt confident were empty, according to the report. When Geller identified what he sensed was an empty can, he would ask the CIA representative to remove it from the table. When only two or three cans remained, Geller would announce which one he thought contained the individual target objects. He had no difficulty identifying the location of water, steel ball bearings, or small magnets, according to the CIA report. This task was performed 12 times without error. The probability that this could have occurred by chance alone is 1 in a trillion. In another filmed test, the CIA had its first opportunity to witness Geller perform psychokinesis in a controlled laboratory environment. The test involved a delicate laboratory balance, i.e. a scale, designed to measure weights ranging from 1 milligram to 50 grams. A 1 gram mass was placed on the pan, and the balance was then covered with a bell jar. A chart monitor continuously recorded the force applied to the balance, producing a paper record of the events. Geller was brought into the room, checked for magnets and electronic devices, and asked to try to perturb the balance. In archival film footage declassified by the CIA, Geller is seen waving his hands several inches above the balance, then clutching his hands into fists and raising them to his temples in what would become his signature theatrical style. On several occasions, the subject caused the balance to respond as though a force were applied to the pan, Putoff and Targ wrote in the CIA report. This was evidenced by a corresponding displacement shown by the chart recorder. These displacements increased from 50 to 1500 milligrams. The scientist's conclusion: the experiment indicated an apparent ability of Geller to affect the apparatus by an as yet unidentified means. The notion that Geller was being tested at SRI made its way into the upper echelons of the Pentagon. So did a declaration by Putoff and Targ that they used only strict laboratory controls. Because of the history of charlatanism in this area, the scientists wrote in their CIA report, our efforts to detect fraud were quite sophisticated, including the use of a consultant magician on our part. This claim caught the attention of Colonel Austin Kibler, director of the Human Resources Research Office at the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, the Pentagon's top military science division. If Geller can do what he claims he can do, we should be involved, Kibler said, and requested to have Geller tested by his own people. An ARPA project manager named George Lawrence, accompanied by two civilian psychologists, Robert Vandecastle and Ray Hyman, traveled to SRI to test Geller on their own. Their conclusion, later reported in Time magazine, was that anyone who believed in Geller's powers was falling for the ridiculous. The CIA asked to attend ARPA's briefing on its assessment of the SRI psychic research program. According to declassified documents, the ARPA group expressed concern that Putoff's and Targ's own experimental bias in favor of successful outcomes is undermining their objectivity in properly controlled experimental procedures. They opined that Putoff and Targ were guilty of the same three claims Martin Gardner had leveled against J.B. Rhine's research decades before. 1. Loose laboratory controls. 2. Skewing of data, and 3. The premise that the attitude of the scientists conducting the experiment, i.e. Lawrence and Hyman, could negatively influence the subject or psychic, i.e. Geller. Austin Kibler and George Lawrence believe there is serious doubt that Geller's accomplishment transcends the range of activities that a skillful magician can perform, they said. The CIA's analyst came to an alternative conclusion as far as Geller was concerned. It strikes me that what is of interest to CIA is not whether Geller's perceptions are sensory or extrasensory, but rather whether his capabilities are exploitable by CIA. When the ARPA team learned that the CIA was continuing its work with Geller, they contacted a senior editor at Time magazine named Leon Jaroff. ARPA's George Lawrence told Jaroff that Geller was a charlatan and encouraged the magazine to write an exposé of him. For Lawrence, a Defense Department employee, to speak with a reporter without authorization was a violation of his security clearance. At CIA, an investigation ensued. Jaroff says the source of the information was Dr. George Lawrence of ARPA. Lawrence, on the other hand, denies having talked to Time. Jaroff says this is nonsense. Lawrence has talked to Time lots of times, declassified documents reveal. The prediction by the Pentagon was coming true. As long as the ESP research field remained polarized in a childish battle between true believers and the incredulous who dismiss the matter out of hand, Schmeidler's sheep versus goats, little progress was likely to be made. But the battle was only beginning. Ray Hyman, the psychologist contracted by ARPA, and Martin Gardner, author of Fads and Fallacies, joined forces in an anti-Geller crusade. Gardner told Time that Geller's supporters reminded him of the supporters of Nazism. Belief in occultism provides a climate for the rise of a demagogue, he said. I think this is precisely what happened in Nazi Germany before the rise of Hitler. A reporter at Time, Stefan Kanfer, targeted SRI for blame. SRI should be destroyed for carrying out this kind of research, Kanfer said. That's the way fascism began. A popular magician and Houdini impersonator named James Randall Zwinge, who went by the name James Randi, made things personal. Geller brings disgrace to the craft I practice, he declared. Worse than that, he warps the thinking of a young generation of forming minds, and that is unforgivable. Randi spent the next 2 years writing his own 308-page exposé of Geller. One of the things he found most offensive about Geller, he wrote, was that he felt Geller had single-handedly ruined the careers of respectable scientists like Andrea Puharic. Just how did a man of the learning and intelligence of Andrea Puharic ever get sucked into the Geller following? Randi asked in all seriousness, insisting that Geller had done more to destroy what authority Puharic once held in the scientific community than Puharic would be able to recover from. In the midst of this chaotic time, Kit Green received a telephone call at his CIA office. It was Hal Putoff on the line. The men discussed the growing controversy around Uri Geller and SRI. Putoff told Green he remained convinced that Geller had ESP and PK capabilities. He can see things at a distance, Putoff said. Green remembers saying something like, no, he can't. Putoff asked Green to speak to Geller directly. He's right here, Putoff said. Geller and Green had never spoken before. Putoff introduced Green to Geller as a scientific colleague on the East Coast, and explained that his colleague was curious about Geller's ability to see things far away. Putoff suggested they do a test. Geller asked Green to select a book, any book in his office, and leave it open in front of him on his desk. Geller requested that the page exposed be something with a strong visual component. When this call came in, Green had been working on a classified study dealing with the neurological effects of a certain Soviet bioweapon on the human brain. Green opened a book that contained medical illustrations of the human nervous system, flipped through the pages, and landed on a picture of a cross-section of the human brain. I'd written "Architecture of a Viral Infection" in bold black ink across the top of the page, he explains. As requested, Green stared at the image with intent. He told Geller when he had done so. Inside the lab at SRI, with Hal Puthoff sitting beside him, Geller began making sketches on a sheet of paper. After a few moments, Green recalls Geller telling him that he'd made a drawing of a pan of scrambled eggs. Then he said, "I have the word architecture coming in strong," remembers Green. In 2015, Puthoff recalled his similar account. "I was baffled," says Green. "How could Geller have seen what I was working on? It was implausible that SRI could have covert visual access to his CIA office, where he worked on highly classified intelligence programs." This was late 1972, decades before real-time video technologies like Skype and FaceTime were available to civilians. Still, it bothered Green that Puthoff had initiated the call. "When the time came," says Green, "I would initiate my own test and make it fail-safe against fraud." In the meantime, Green supported Puthoff and Targ in their conclusion as physicists in what the CIA called in memos the Swan-Geller phenomena. "We have observed certain phenomena for which we have no scientific explanation," wrote Puthoff and Targ. Officers at headquarters had their say. "The paranormal field is so delicate, so suspect, so potentially explosive, that only the most orderly of plebeian approaches seems likely to survive the bureaucratic atmosphere," one agency representative wrote. "Let me state simply that I, at the present time, neither believe nor disbelieve in the phenomena, although I must frankly admit that, like